Coming up next is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, new ways to treat epilepsy and seizure disorders.
Depending upon what kind of seizure it is, you may use one or another different group of medications. There are now about 20 medications out there.
Then, eating disorders as a public health concern.
Generally, adolescent females are most at risk, but we're seeing a lot of males with eating disorders, a lot of women in midlife with eating disorders, and so it's no longer a disease exclusively of adolescent females.
And the importance of exercise in treating cancer.
Research is showing that moderate levels of exercise is helping people maintain their function, maintain strength, maintain their energy.
We'll get our checkup from the neck up, hear from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we examine eating disorders as a public health concern, plus the benefits of exercise during and after cancer treatment. But first, we take a closer look at epilepsy and seizure disorders. Well, over 2 million people in the United States have epilepsy, and the consequences of having this disease can be quite severe and include a shortened lifespan, serious bodily injury, neuropsychological and psychiatric impairments, and social disabilities. Well, here with more on this debilitating problem is Dr. Robert Beach. He's professor of neurology and the director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center and of the Clinical Neurophysiology Laboratories at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Beach. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So going all the way back to antiquity, epilepsy is quite an old disease, and it obviously led to so much stigmatization because basically, it was very poorly understood, this kind of behavior that would come upon someone. So help us understand, what exactly do we mean when we say epilepsy? What is it?
Well, epilepsy is the tendency to have seizures, and everybody can have seizures if they're provoked adequately. For example, alcohol withdrawal seizures are not epilepsy, but anybody who tends to have them without provocation has epilepsy.
And what exactly is a seizure then?
A seizure is outwardly ranges from subtle to very violent movements, but neurologically it involves synchronization of large amounts of electrical activity in the brain. And the most common one that people recognize is when somebody stiffens all over, may let out a yell, and then jerks, and afterwards is very difficult to arouse.
So the point is, it's a neurological disorder, epilepsy is, and then there's sudden recurrent episodes that just come upon the person where they go into some kind of a stiffened state or some kind of jerking state, and something is actually, that's on the outside, but in their brain there's this release of electrical activity that's excessive. I mean, is that exactly what's going on?
Yes, it's excessive synchronization. Some people think of it as a balance between excitation and inhibition, but it involves more in circuits that are involved and synchronization. I just want to clarify that the generalized seizures that I mentioned before are actually not the most common kind. They're the most recognized kind. People often have much more subtle ones that can involve staring and reduced responsiveness as well.
Yeah, there's a term I've heard years ago called petit mal seizures. Is that part of epilepsy? And if so, what exactly is happening then?
Petit mal is a very common term referring to what we would call non-convulsive or non-motor seizures. In the general public, it's referred to define a couple of different seizure types, but classically, it's what we call absence seizures, and it's most often seen in children. Sometimes in school, they're noticed to be not paying attention.
Like staring, like you mentioned.
Staring off, usually for 5 to 20 seconds. But a lot of people who have what we call complex partial seizures also look like that, and they are often labeled by a family or others as having petit mal, but we try to avoid that, make that distinction, because the treatments are different.
So bottom line is, though, when you talk about epilepsy, those are the kinds of seizures you've just described fall into that category.
Yes.
So do we know what causes it? I mean, we might be able to say what's happening at that moment in the brain, but where does it come from?
Well, there's a very large number of causes of epilepsy. Some of them are inherited and genetic, and those tend to involve neurotransmitters and ion channels within the neurons. Those also tend to occur early in life. There are also ones that occur due to inherent underlying conditions where somebody has some sort of brain abnormality. Tuberous sclerosis would be one example that's fairly common. But if somebody has a stroke or an injury, those are also potential sources of epilepsy.
And they will go on to continue having those kinds of seizures? I mean, when you use the term epilepsy, it means it's going to go on and
right.
on.
They may, and those that do would have epilepsy, yes.
So generally you were alluding to the fact that there can be a family history of this, or there's a genetic predisposition. Who generally is most at risk? I mean, do we have a characterization of a typical epileptic patient, I guess, is the question.
Well, the genetic connection varies, and it's not almost in any case a single gene, although there are a few, but there are many, many genes that have an influence on the excitability, and these tend to show up in familial patterns. If you have members of the family with epilepsy, then your risk is increased, but there's varying grades of that risk. And also, even among people who don't have a family history, there's often an increased risk because they may have the underlying condition but not actually reach the situation where they have seizures.
So you've already alluded to the fact that you can have a seizure but not really have epilepsy. Tell me some of the circumstances where that occurs.
Well, probably one of the most common circumstances is if somebody has a blackout or a syncope, or some people say dropout.
Is that when you say syncope, you meaning some kind of an arrhythmia?
Those are often caused by arrhythmia, but they can also be caused if somebody has poor control of their vessels and they stand up and all the blood flows to their legs and away from their brain. And when somebody has a blackout because of this decreased blood flow, they often have some movements. And sometimes they look like seizures. Sometimes it'll trigger seizures. But really, there are many different things that can perturb our blood system or homeostatic system that will cause seizures. And in the hospital, we see very many people who have seizures but don't have epilepsy. In the public, there's also causes related to other neurologic disorders that may not be epilepsy because they don't recur.
So is the definitive criteria, or one of the definitive criteria for calling it epilepsy, that it is a recurrent problem?
Recurrent and unprovoked.
Yes, unprovoked. In other words, nothing else is happening. It just comes upon you,
exactly.
So to speak. So at one point, I read somewhere that there are people, because of this potential for having seizure and not being epileptic, I mean, not really having epilepsy, that they can be misdiagnosed in some way. I mean, has that been your experience, that you see people who literally, patients who have been misdiagnosed and perhaps put on anticonvulsants when in fact they're non-epileptic?
Yes, that's actually something we see quite a bit of. People who have things that look like seizures are often thought to have seizures, and because seizures are somewhat misunderstood and considered so dangerous, people often treat them as if they're seizures, even when they're not absolutely proven to be seizures. So sometimes we will see patients who've been diagnosed as having seizures or epilepsy and treated with drugs, but actually turn out to have some sort of condition that's not epilepsy. One example would be people who have a psychological reaction and have spells that look like seizures. We call these generally psychogenic non-epileptic seizures.
So what's the consequence of that if they've been put it on an anticonvulsant? I mean, are there, you know, basically consequences that follow?
Yeah, unfortunately, not only do they have the potential side effects short and long term of the medications, but they also have the problems associated with recurrent seizures, inability to drive, inability to work, possibly disturbed relationships, socioeconomic status, and many other factors.
So basically what you're saying is a definitive diagnosis is really crucial in to enable you to both treat the person and for them to have a good prognosis.
Yes, and usually the diagnosis is made by primarily by getting a history and then doing a very limited number of tests. And the most useful test is really the EEG, but that is not always positive in people who have epilepsy, and sometimes it can be misinterpreted. In addition, looking at the structure of the brain with an MRI is the other major tool that's
used. So imaging studies, basically,
yes,
are the key. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neurologist Dr. Robert Beach. We're talking about epilepsy. So let's get back to that. Are there laboratory tests, first of all, that you use as well to try to get a definitive diagnosis that this is truly epilepsy?
Well, the most useful test we use is actually what we call video EEG monitoring. And this is where a patient is in a very controlled environment, usually in the hospital, and we can witness and record the brainwaves during their seizures and determine not only whether or not these truly are seizures, but also what kind they are and possibly where they're coming from, because that may lead to the possibility of surgery. We also have genetic tests for some of the genetic epilepsies, but those are fairly limited so far.
So the key is that imaging seems to be the kind of state of the art these days with a video EEG, and that gives you a lot of information that you can follow up in terms of the type and also look potential location for treatment.
Right.
So what are some of the consequences of epilepsy if you don't treat it? I mean, what happens to these people if they're not treated?
Well, there's a very strong correlation between numbers of seizures that's been known for hundreds of years and the lifespan. It's also, seizures can cause decreased function because they can damage areas of the brain that are important.
So, excuse me for interrupting, but you're saying that you have a decreased lifespan if it's left untreated.
If the, what we call before the generalized convulsive seizures were the stiffening and jerking, those can decrease lifespan, and there's old studies that show that. For some people, like those who have just the childhood absence seizures, it has very little effect on them except for the inability to pay attention until they're treated. And then there's in the middle, there's these partial seizures that may be subtle or may be fairly clearly visible. And these can damage whatever part of the brain is involved over time. Usually one individual seizure is not damaging, but multiple ones may be.
I also read somewhere, and actually I think we've interviewed some people on this show, talking about the potential for developmental delays in children with learning problems and concomitant social difficulties if left untreated in children. So obviously that causes a lot of problems. So when do you treat? And what type of treatments, let's start with maybe the medications that are used.
So once somebody is defined with a seizure, you have to consider the possibility that it may recur. And you have to evaluate that with some of the things we talked about, the tests and the history. If it's clear that it's got a high likelihood of recurring, then you want to treat it. Depending upon what kind of seizure it is, you may use one or another different group of medications. There are now about 20 medications out there. And, for example, for the childhood absence epilepsy, only a few of them are very useful. And they're not necessarily, they're not the same ones all that are useful for the other seizure types. So you have to identify the seizure type.
So that's crucial. You have to identify the type. And then you do trials, I guess, of whatever anticonvulsants there are and figure out what's most effective?
Well, usually you want to treat it as quickly as possible, so you try to pick the best one. And often that's actually decided not just by the seizure, but what the other problems the patient has. Some of the seizure drugs are extremely effective in treating other conditions like migraines and some depression.
How about non-pharmacologic therapy? What other kinds of things are there out there to help people with seizure?
Well, usually if somebody either is unable to take medication or fails medications, and usually we're talking about failing a few, they can try other things. One that's in the news a lot is the ketogenic diet, and that's a diet that's been proven useful in some children with epilepsy, but it's a little bit hard to maintain because you have to avoid carbohydrate virtually completely and have high levels of fats. There is also the option of surgery for some patients, and that's one of the things that we specialize in epilepsy centers.
Just very quickly, what's this thing called the VNS or the vagal nerve stimulation? I don't want to run out of time, so.
The vagal nerve stimulator is a pacemaker-like device that goes in the chest wall and stimulates the vagal nerve in the neck. And for not really well-known reasons, this reduces numbers of seizures in many people. It's ideal because it doesn't have the side effects of medication for some people. It doesn't have sedation, different problems with coordination, and other things.
So very quickly, again, because I don't want to run out of time, surgery has really taken a leap forward in some ways. I mean, surgery has always been involved. You've always been doing surgery for epilepsy, but today there are different techniques. Quickly tell us.
Yes, surgery is relatively new and becoming a little bit more commonly used. There's considered to be a lot of people who don't get treated. We have, and several other centers, use a newer device that does not involve opening up the skull, that is a laser probe that can be put into the area where the seizure is and destroy that to stop the seizures.
So it's this ablation. You're basically going in and just kind of getting rid of the spot that's causing the problem, and you don't have all that other damage that could take place when you do an open procedure.
Exactly, and people usually get to go home pretty quickly afterwards.
So it's a hopeful picture today for epilepsy. Is that true?
Yes, I think so.
Thank you so very much for coming in. And obviously there are more things on the horizon. Maybe as things start to develop, you'll come back and talk with us again. That would be great. My guest has been Dr. Robert Beach. He's professor of neurology. He's the director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center and of the Clinical Neurophysiology Laboratories at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, eating disorders as a public health concern. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Upstate medical student Nicole Sifra's passion for adolescent medicine has earned her the 2015 United States Public Health Service Excellence in Public Health Award. And she's joining us today to tell us more about her commitment. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand that right now you're currently on track to earn an MD-MPH degree. That's a Master's of Public Health. And you'll do that in 2015. Tell me, what is this degree and why did you choose to get involved in it?
So the MD-MPH program is a pretty new program. You matriculate in the medical school but also have an opportunity to earn an MPH with the new CNY-MPH program. And so in the middle of second and third year, I took a year off and completed most of the public health coursework and my field placement. And I pursued this because I had an interest in adolescent medicine, and a lot of the issues that adolescent medicine deals with are very public health focused. And also I have an interest in teaching and academic medicine, and so having the MPH really would help me fulfill that goal.
So why adolescent medicine? What drove you, engages you about adolescent medicine, and then what about adolescent medicine? Because I know you focused on something very specific.
So I guess I've always been the type of person that just when I see a need, I really feel compelled to fill it. And when I was a patient growing up in high school and early college, I kind of noticed that The adolescent young adult population was a little bit of this no man's land between pediatrics and internal medicine. And I had that experience, and a few of my friends had those experiences. And when I was a medical student, I started to notice some of the same things. And so I kind of just wanted to be a part of the solution in filling that gap.
So when you say a no man's land, did you think that this population in some ways is being underserved by our current medical system? Is that what you're saying?
I think that it's kind of like it's at the fringe at the end of pediatrics, and at the beginning of internal medicine, and the issues that adolescents have are so unique. And sometimes I've noticed that physicians can shy away from those age groups. And so I just kind of wanted to learn more about that so I could be really effective in helping that population.
And perhaps the shying away is also because of the lack of training in specific in the issues that address adolescents. So is a part of it also the need to develop programming, training programming that addresses adolescent medicine specifically?
Yeah, it's interesting because I have a mentor down in Austin, Texas, and he recently spoke at a congressional briefing about training with eating disorders specifically, which is a field I'm interested in, because adolescent medicine is currently the only training program that requires any sort of exposure to eating disorder patients. Not even psychiatry or child psychiatry has that.
Wow.
Which is surprising. And so I think that's part of the advocacy that a lot of people in this field have been a part of.
So getting back to this idea of adolescence and public health, you particularly have focused on eating disorders as an area of great need.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit more about why and what you see or what you have seen, both in your own development, but also now as a medical student, MPH student.
So I think eating disorders are very unique because they are they're classified as mental illnesses with the DSM-5, which is a diagnostic manual used in the field of psychiatry, but they're also medical consequences that need to be monitored and medical signs that need to be looked for. And so it's a very complicated interaction between the medical and the mental health. And in addition to that, all the public health issues, such as familial factors, cultural factors, differences in, who an individual, has as their friend group, those can all be either protective factors or risk factors.
So this peer pressure obviously is going to potentially either be a risk factor or a protective factor.
Right. It all kind of depends on how everything interacts.
So you basically see anorexia, nervosa, bulimia, and binge eating as public health concerns.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the direction you're coming from. Why public health, though? I mean, how do you think that it actually constitutes a public health concern?
Mm-hmm. I think that because of all these different factors that go into the development or lack of development of these diseases are very rooted in societal principles. You know, there's advertising that, everyone talks about that has these unrealistic images. There are,
Well, do you think at this point the cultural mandates today still are in fact contributing largely to this problem?
I do. I think that that's a major part. I don't think it's the full issue, but I think it definitely has a part to play.
So do you see that it's limited? At this point, who is most at risk? It's hard to know what the figures are these days, but it sounds like still girls are most affected. But what do you see?
Yeah, so, generally adolescent females are most at risk, but we're seeing a lot of males with eating disorders, a lot of women in midlife with eating disorders. And so it's no longer a disease exclusively of adolescent females. And so I think that's what throws people off a little bit, is that it creeps up in these populations we wouldn't necessarily think of.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Upstate medical student Nicole Sifra, and we're talking about her passion for adolescent medicine and public health, as well as eating disorders. So you've been involved with in an international way with eating disorders. Tell us about that experience.
So I, about a year ago, I started working with the Patient Care Task Force, and that comes out of the Academy of Eating Disorders, which is a professional organization for a variety of health professionals working with the eating disorder population. And the Patient Care Task Force, which is what I'm a part of, focuses on integrating the experiences and the views of those who have suffered from eating disorders and their family members and caretakers into the context of the general organization. And so it's been interesting for me as a future pediatrician to hear the experiences of parents whose children have suffered from these diseases. And I think it's been a really good educational opportunity for me.
Do you think those that information that you're learning from the people who've actually lived the problem will affect treatment protocols or the way in which we approach eating disorders? I mean, do you think it will have a strong impact?
Mm-hmm. I think it will, and I think it has already. One of the gold standard treatments for anorexia nervosa is something called the Maudsley method, which is where the parents and caretakers are intimately involved in not only caring for their child's nutritional needs, but being a part of family therapy. And so I think that the family members are really starting to become more integrated in the treatment.
Do you have any sense that the basically what's going on with the cultural and familial factors right now, do you see in an international level that there are similarities? Because this involvement, I guess you've been involved with people from the Netherlands, from Japan, from Australia. Mm-hmm. Are there universals that seem to cut across countries, or do you think that this is largely an American problem?
You know, it's interesting because when I first started studying eating disorders, I thought of it as kind of an American issue because I grew up in America, and so that's kind of all I knew. But speaking with these people from different countries, I noticed more similarities than differences in their experiences. And so I think that's really important just to know that this is a bigger issue, and there are people around the world that are suffering from these issues.
I understand that you are only one of 57 medical students nationwide to win this award, and that it was presented to you in kind of there was a little hijinks involved in you getting the award. You want to share that with us?
Right. So my one of the people that I work with student government is Dr. Julie White. She's the Dean of Student Affairs. And so she had told me that she wanted me to stop by her office, and I thought it would be something student government related, something that maybe I had done that she didn't like or something someone else had done. And so I was a little hesitant, but she presented me with this award, which was a fun surprise.
Very exciting. Yeah. So tell me very briefly then, you know, you've been now involved, you've heard about what's going on in other countries, you've heard about what people who have had the experience, parents and maybe some of their kids, mm-hmm. who've had this problem with eating disorders. Where do you see the physician's role? I mean, what can a physician really do in those situations? How effective can they be? Clearly, you said there are medical and emotional issues, but there are medical consequences. So a physician needs to be involved, perhaps in monitoring or what have you. But what can a physician actually do?
I think from my perspective, and I say this in the most humble way possible because I know that I'm a medical student and still have a lot to learn at this point, but I think that the biggest place that a physician can be most effective is identifying the eating disorder and knowing how to look for, signs and symptoms, because a lot of times patients will go to great lengths to hide those. And so these diseases can kind of masquerade as other illnesses. So I think that's really the most important part.
And perhaps supporting the family and finding programming that can be addressing these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see more and more, and locally you've been involved in some organizations that have been dealing with eating disorders. What's your sense of where our programming is today?
Mm-hmm. So so I work with the adolescent clinic here at Upstate with Dr. Karen Thielen, and she's been a great mentor and role model to me, just not in interacting with patients with eating disorders, but a lot of other adolescent health issues. And so she's a wonderful resource to families who are looking to kind of tackle these issues. Also, I work with Ophelia's Place, which is in Liverpool, and they provide a lot of support services and also treatment through the Upstate New York Eating Disorder Service, who rents space there. And so they provide kind of the family component, some support groups that are therapist-led, and just kind of a lot of community support, because these diseases can be kind of isolating.
Do you see the kids making progress? From your experience?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of hope in the treatment of eating disorders. And sometimes people can kind of view it as a helpless thing, like this person will struggle with this a lot for the rest of their lives. But I think there is a lot of hope. And when I went to the conference for the Academy of Eating Disorders, I learned a lot of new things that people are discovering, new treatments that are coming out. And some studies looking into genetic components. And so we really are learning more every day. And it's a very hopeful field. And so I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes in the future.
And that sounds like what you're going to be headed to do.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Nicole, for coming in and sharing this all with us. My guest has been Upstate Medical student Nicole Sifra. And she is pursuing an MD MPH degree at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill. With this week's checkup from the neck up, mom's death and tying up loose ends. Well, folks, my mother was like many children of the Great Plains farms and Great Depression. She knew the great dust storms and cold, hunger, and bone-deep want. And she developed a magnificent, albeit a bit frustrating at times, frugality. After she went home from visits to us in her later years, we would find rubber bands and bread bag twistums squirreled away in our kitchen drawers, despite gentle reminders that her previous efforts had provided for any eventuality this side of nuclear war and complete economic meltdown. In any event, after Mom's death at 97 a few months ago, at her nursing home, I discovered a drawer full of, quote, perfectly good still, end quote, empty medication cups, slightly used napkins, partially tooth combs and rubber bands, and even a couple of bread bag twistums. Where she got those, I don't know. No real surprise there, but her passing has brought a number of unexpected experiences for us, including, for one, as I was reviewing her life and writing her eulogy, a changing appreciation of just how her life experiences shaped her character, and how her character and choices shaped her marriage, her family, her life, and me, with this prompting a review of my own life's pretty funs and not so funs so far. For two, a looking ahead to my likely time left and a sorting into chuck it or bucket lists, if you will. Like, just how much do we want to see the pyramids, or do another research project, or learn to sing in tune? A real challenge there. For three, a new sense of responsibility. And what remains to be done for and with our boys, now two wonderful young men? What do we want to say to them and do with them before we say goodbye? How many kisses and hugs can we get in? And one final surprise from Mom. In her closet, on the suit she wanted to wear on her final journey, she had pinned a note several years ago. Quote, to all my friends and relatives, God is watching over each of us. So long for now, and we'll meet every one of us later. Bye, Mom. Love forever. At her memorial celebration, I gave everyone a copy of that note and a twistum in the shape of a heart. I made two for myself. When I see them around our house, I remember her, and my heart fills up. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, the benefits of exercise in treating cancer. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of May 24th. Strategize to subdue stress. There are many ways to beat stress, but you'll find that some work better than others. Keeping a positive attitude, stepping out of the situation, enjoying a laugh, accepting that there are things we cannot control, and asserting your feelings instead of becoming angry or passive are all methods that can lead to less stress and a happier life. This week, consider which tools have worked for you before and perhaps try out some new ones. Having a few go-to stress-reducing techniques up your sleeve can make all the difference. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen joining you. In the past, people treated for a chronic illness like cancer were often told by their doctor to rest and reduce their physical activity. But newer research has shown that exercise is not only safe and possible during cancer treatment, but it can actually improve how well you function physically and the quality of your life. Joining us with more on this is Cassie Turpening, who holds a doctorate in physical therapy and specializes in oncology rehabilitation at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for coming
in. Hi. Thank you for having me.
So why not rest? I mean, why exercise?
Well, research is showing that moderate levels of exercise during treatment or management of cancer is helping people maintain their function, maintain strength, maintain their energy. So, you know, it helps with, you know, just keeping them going and kind of helping them through their healing process.
And actually, there have been actual research studies that have shown that looking at two populations, people with breast cancer, for example, who hadn't exercised versus ones who have, the ones who have really have had longer lives and better outcomes. Is that also true?
Yeah, more and more research about this is coming out. It's kind of a, you know, a popular topic right now. You know, it's, you know, exercise has health benefits for everyone, but especially in, you know, individuals who already have some issues or, you know, health conditions.
So I know that one of the biggest problems with cancer treatments or one of the biggest side effects is fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're so tired, how do you muster the energy for exercise? And in effect, does it actually help with fatigue?
Yes, exercise can help with fatigue. You know, we talk with our patients about, you know, activity modification, pacing, and saving energy in some places to be used for exercise. So if you save energy during cooking, you can use the energy, you know, later in the day for walking or biking or, you know, some other more physical activity that you enjoy.
So some of it is a pacing kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, kind of saving the energy and making time for that, you know, later in the day when you're, you know, when your energy levels are at their best.
One other thing that I read somewhere was that also this notion of elevating your mood. It seems to me that during something as serious and as somber as a diagnosis of cancer and then treatment, obviously people have all kinds of emotional reactions to that. What have you found in terms of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's known that exercise can induce or increase endorphins. So that, you know, that just makes everybody generally feel better. But
And then the other issue is weight control, which it seems to me that people do gain weight or don't gain weight after
typically weight loss is a problem, you know. So the intention of exercise is to, you know, maintain or improve strength and function, not to lose weight. So, you know, it's important that, you know, they watch their diet, make sure they're taking in enough calories, because you don't want to, you know, encourage increased weight loss.
But if anything, I would think it could also increase appetite.
And, again,
and you're willing. So how about if you're a person who's never exercised, and here you now have a diagnosis of cancer and all of the concomitant pressures and difficulties that go along with getting treatment?
Yeah, I mean, that's partly why our program was developed. You know, we help patients create individualized plans for exercise and you know, massage and stuff like that to help get them feeling better. But we, you know, we help start them on a program, and we start very slowly, and, you know, and we help them build up. So we can kind of step by step help people, you know, progress or start exercising.
So what kind of, I mean, basically what type of exercise is recommended? I mean, you're making it sound like you want to start slowly, obviously, but is it, are there obviously some types of exercise that are better than others?
It's very patient specific, you know, so it depends on, you know, the person's activity level, what kind of cancer they are, kind of where they are in the stage of cancer or treatment. But, you know, it's recommended that, you know, most of us, or we all exercise up to 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. So, you know, that's kind of the end goal. But even if it's just a few minutes here and a few minutes there, you know, just slowly increasing to, you know, what's recommended.
So basically this is being encouraged all the time now with new cancer treatment. Centers and people and teams are basically saying the new protocol is really to get people active and to try to stay active all the way through and after cancer treatment.
Correct. Yep. As a physical therapist, we're working as part of a multidisciplinary team. So we're working with, you know, the doctors and the nurse practitioners and the nurses, you know, kind of all-encompassing, trying to help all of these patients.
So what are the components of a really effective exercise program? I mean, you always have the aerobic issue, the strength training, potentially stretching and flexibility. What are those basically the main components that
exist? I mean, certainly aerobic exercise, and usually walking is safe for everybody. You know,
how about a stationary bicycle? Is that usually something that is accepted as a reasonable thing to do?
Yep. You know, if somebody has access to one, you know, at home or a gym, and then they're comfortable on it, then it's definitely an okay thing to do.
So in addition with aerobic, what else?
Some strengthening exercises, you know, and some stretching just to cover all of your bases. But, you know, strengthening for legs, arms, core.
And do you need to use weights for that kind of thing, or can you do kind of isometric type exercises?
Well, do exercises using your own body weight. So, you know, you can create a program, you know, that you can do at home without any equipment.
So do you need, I mean, basically it sounds to me like, and you've already alluded to a program that you're involved with, would you recommend, or do you think you need a physical therapist to help set up a personalized program? Is that most desirable for you?
I would say it's probably helpful for most people, you know, unless you have a, you know, significant background or you've been exercising for a long time. You know, sometimes it's just good to have a little help to know, you know, what's safe to do, what maybe you should or shouldn't do, some suggestions.
I mean, for example, I saw that there were exercises specifically prescribed for things like to prevent lymphedema, things that come with side effects of treatment.
Yeah.
And to improve range of motion if you've had certain kinds of treatment.
Yeah, so that's why it would be helpful to, you know, consult with, you know, a medical professional or a physical therapist or an occupational therapist to help kind of bring some of these things to your attention.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with physical therapist Dr. Cassie Turpening. We're talking about the benefits of exercise for cancer patients. So what should you watch out for? I mean, what are the potential pitfalls in terms of, you know, I would think that especially people who maybe were very active or had exercised a great deal prior to their diagnosis might potentially overdo it. Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility. You know, usually we recommend or we suggest that, you know, you continue on with your current level of activity. So, you know, kind of trying to maintain or keep doing the things that you were doing and then kind of, you know, adding on to that.
But if you have a person, let's say you were a marathon runner, mm-hmm. and you ended up now with some kind of a cancer, and you needed to have treatment, mm-hmm. are there some limitations that you would want to place on someone who is undergoing treatment? I mean, I would think fatigue alone might play a role, but...
Yeah, I mean, fatigue can be a problem. And, you know, most people who have cancer suffer from fatigue at some level. You know, so usually, you know, during treatment, you know, just kind of starting slow, see how your body is responding to the exercise and the treatment and the things that are happening, you know, at that time. You know, monitoring fatigue, making sure that when you're done exercising, the fatigue is not, you know, to a point where it's not manageable. I mean, we should all feel a little bit tired when we're done exercising, but you want to make sure that you're not, you know, so tired where you're not able to do anything the next day. So that's definitely something to consider.
Basically start slowly and proceed and basically progress incrementally to see how you do. Go mm-hmm. ahead. You
were No, absolutely. You know, kind of just making sure that you are going to be, you know, doing okay with what you're trying to do.
What if you don't have the energy, for example, for a full half hour? Because you said the goal would be 30 minutes 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if you can't quite do that? What's good enough?
Yeah, I mean, walking for a few minutes at a time, you know, throughout the day is also found to be beneficial. So if you can only walk for 2 or 3 minutes at a time, then, you know, walking 2 or 3 minutes in the morning, walking a few minutes in the afternoon, and then walking a little bit in the evening, just kind of slowly building up. And as you can, you know, trying to add a little bit more time to that.
How about things, just the more routine things like gardening or house cleaning? Do those count?
Yeah.
If you were to do that in place?
Yeah, any physical activity that kind of gets you, you know, moving and expending a little more energy.
And how about, like, things like yoga, tai chi, all of those kinds of ancillary, they're not really aerobic exercises,
but... Yeah. But absolutely. I mean, those all help with strength and balance and, you know, conditioning. So those are all beneficial things. You know, it's best to pick something that you're interested in. So if you, you know, enjoy yoga, then, you know, do yoga. If you like Pilates, then, you know, try Pilates.
So the idea really is to have something that you can do within your capability,
mm-hmm.
do it slowly and incrementally, see how you function with it in the context of mm-hmm. your therapy. And then obviously try not to overdo so you end up exhausted, because that, I would think, would have some negative effects on mm-hmm. your overall
And it's good to touch base with your medical provider to make sure that it is okay for you to be doing some of these things. You know, some other things to kind of watch out for. You know, you don't want to exercise if you're really not feeling well or you're having, you know, pretty significant nausea. Also,
or a fever.
Yeah, or a fever over 100.4, you know, that is indicating maybe a little bit of infection or just something going on. And, you know, at that point, touching base with your doctor. But those are things to kind of, you know, watch out for. Pain. We want to make sure
clearly.
That pain, you don't want to do anything that's going to, you know, provoke pain or increase the pain that you may already be having, you know.
So you were alluding to this program that you have here at Upstate that you're a part of
mm-hmm.
that works specifically with cancer patients. Do you think in general it's helpful to find programs of that nature because maybe you have more support or more, you know, personalized care?
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to your medical provider and they say it's okay for you to exercise and you're comfortable kind of creating your own program and kind of moving on from there, then, you know, I would say that that's okay. If you're feeling like you are having questions or concerns or you're just not sure what to do, then sometimes getting a little bit of help from, you know, an exercise professional may be helpful, whether it is a PT or, you know, a trainer that you've worked with in the past. Some gyms in the area have some programs for people with cancer. So, you know, there are things to reach out to if you're feeling like you need a little bit of help.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so very much for coming in and filling us in on all that. My guest has been Dr. Cassie Turpening. She holds a doctorate in physical therapy and specializes in oncology rehabilitation at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again, Cassie.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Makandawana Shoniwa is a medical student here at SUNY Upstate. She writes poetry that reflects the journeys she has taken in her life. Here is a very thoughtful meditation called The Forging. Can a thorn tree bear fruit? Well, you did. And when you had borne us, war and thirst drove us to the forests of the West, beckoned by promises of peace and plenty. But we were children of the thorn tree. The young thorn cannot grow in such lush lands. The new land rejected us. We were the thorn in its side. It was then we knew. The thorn is born to grow in the desert, where others fear death. The thorn tree survives, rugged and brittle. It is no water lily, as those seen in the east, beautiful and pleasant to the eye. The thorn is a wretched scar, marring the land. Thorns, we were born for the land of little. We were born to suffer, made ugly by the Creator, so only the thorn tree could love us. At the tit, we first learnt mother's rejection. In the womb, we killed to survive. We were birthed for a harder life. They say we were spat out by the shadows, formed tough by circumstance. The thorn is no water lily. War is its reality, a battle to find hope. But do not pity the thorn. It survives. It thrives. Sometimes in a mother's rejection, in a castaway's wandering, warriors are forged.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we examine the ravages of acne and how it can be helped. Plus, we take a look at prostate cancer medications and how lessons learned from a comprehensive stroke center are now being shared. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink On Air. That's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.